Thank you for that very nice introduction. Thank you for the invitation to be here with you. But in particular, I want to most sincerely thank QP and QPBC for the kind of leadership you've been showing on all kinds of issues, but closest to my heart on education and education privatization. I think you've really been leaders in making what's happening to public education not just a privatization issue, not just a jobs issue, but a real community issue and an issue of what the hell is this country coming to anyway. For that, I thank you very much. And I have to say, even though I come from Ontario, you guys do have your work cut out for you here. You are meeting the challenge through first-class research and resources and publications and a superb group of allies. One of the things you didn't mention, Deb, but of which I'm most proud, so I'm going to fit it in there, is that I've been the National Vice President of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives for the last 10 years. And I know CCPA BC is dear to the hearts of everyone who wants to see things change. So there are a lot of ways to come at this large subject of privatization of education in BC. And it occurred to me that I could repeat all the facts that I found in all your fabulous publications, about which, of course, you already know. The 44 school closures, the 2,000 teachers who've been lost, the increased class sizes, $210 million cut from the education budget, and, of course, the windfall passed on to private schools. And then there's Bill 34, the open for business corporatization of school boards, the privatization of the open school, contracting out a BC curriculum to kids who never saw a dogwood tree, the relentless attempt to demonize BCTF, contract strip teachers, undermine their right to govern their own profession. All of it is clear evidence that the Campbell government is hell-bent on its agenda of protection, choice, and accountability. Rarely have three words been used more often or more deceptively. So I want to think about how this Orwellian reversal works, why it works in some people's heads and makes sense. We have to understand how and why it works for others if we're going to make it unwork. So although I've got lots of concrete examples of made in BC privatization that we could discuss, I thought tonight I'd look at some of its roots and also contemplate what I think the next wave of education privatization might look like. And I take pride but no satisfaction, I think it's fair to say, in looking back at Class Warfare, published 10 years ago as a blueprint for what happened in Canadian education over the past 10 years. Actually, Maudie and I were together a couple weeks ago, and over about the third glass of wine, we said, you know, we should write another book. She said, what would we call it? And I said, we told you so. So, a little past, a little present, a little future tonight. It seems to me, actually, that education privatization, at least in this country, is proceeding not so much by fiat or by legislation, although we do have examples of both. Instead, it's directed to eroding how we view the purposes and the benefits of public education. So it's really a cultural shift. Privatization succeeds when it becomes inconsequential or invisible, and finally, popular. It succeeds when our mind blurs the distinction between private good and public good. Those of us who are convinced that these distinctions are valid and important have been painted as selfish, opposed to real school improvement, or most offensive of all in the material world, opposed to choice. The language of the words of equity and democracy and school improvement have been stolen by the people who hold not just public education in contempt, but also the whole project of government itself, and therefore everything that government does. Less government, more market. As one of the education advisors to President Bush once told the Washington Post, I don't want to do away with government. Just shrink it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the tub. So everywhere that neoliberalism and neoconservatism thrive, public education is doubly a target. Not only because it's a project of government. I mean, after all, privatizers always call public education state-run schools or government schools. But also because schools pose the greatest threat to interfering with promoting the culture in which privatization flourishes. Because left alone, schools have never prized competition over cooperation, never advocated more failure for many so that success for a few becomes more valuable, never prized superficial learning over the substantial. So the real threat to neoliberalism is that students might discover that the way we organize our economies and our communities and our societies are actually choices, and that there are alternatives. These students could well become the kind of dangerous adults who think for themselves, but also think about others, who can see past quarterly results, who believe that there are limits to how much happiness can be found in getting and spending. So it's controlling mind share, not just market share, that's at the root of privatization. So the most powerful privatization is the kind we come to not mind, the kind we hardly notice, either because it's wearing a disguise, like partnership, or because it closely resembles the system we have, the one we continue to call public, even as it abandons the things that make it public. There's some preconditions, some assumptions that have to be embedded widely before the public is prepared to embrace or tolerate the destruction of their most important public institution, their most important collective asset, public education. I don't know how we get that across to the public. Think of the value. Think of the financial value, if that's one way to look at it, of what we've invested in public education at all levels over the last 100 years. And to imagine that it's no more than the sum of this year's budget allocation is really so bizarre. It is so ahistorical. It is so taken out of context when we look at the contribution to our stability, our economy, our unity. It really doesn't matter. Without public education being what it has been, this would be an extraordinarily different country. So you have to embed some assumptions if you're going to get people to wander away from that truth, to abandon the truth as well as the system. First, people, at least some people, have to believe that what they're really doing is reforming a failed system. Now, this is really tricky. From a PR perspective, if can't you see Donald Trump sitting there and assigning to the apprentices, convince people that public education has failed. You've got 48 hours. So, I mean, it's quite a challenge. It's tricky because most students' and parents' experience with real schools is very positive. Among other indicators of a good system, they've actually good justification for feeling so positive. Among other indicators of a good school system, we have the word of the OECD, which just ranked Canadian 15-year-olds second in the world literacy sweepstakes, just behind Finland, another country that has put a lot of public resources into public education. It's really been a triumph of propaganda when people, especially parents, tell pollsters that their own schools in their own communities are great, and yet believe that the schools other people's kids go to are mediocre or even worse. And yet consistently, that's what public opinion research will tell you about schools. People like the schools they know really well. Nonetheless, they assume the schools on the other side of town, on the other side of the province, and God forbid, on the other side of the country, are somehow going to hell in a handbasket. The public's perception of schools in general, of course, are created by people whose goal is to discredit them so that losing them won't be such a big deal. Now, I've argued for at least a decade that the assault on schools by politicians, much of the national media, and institutions such as the Fraser Institute can only be understood this way, because certainly those opinions were not driven by the data. They never were. And finally, somebody helped me out by making my case in print. Helen Ram of the Fraser Institute was quoted in the National Post after the most recent national poll on the Fraser poll on education was reported. No, this was just a general public opinion poll. And, you know, results varied across the country. It turned out Manitoba and Saskatchewan were substantially more positive about their schools than the average in the other provinces. So the National Post reporter asked Ram what she made of these findings. And she said, oh, that's simple. We just haven't got around to doing school rankings in those provinces yet. I mean, there you have it in black and white. The Frasers' purpose in doing things like school rankings, by their own admission, is not about information. It's about defamation. Of course, there's been a lot of resistance to the Liberal agenda in BC. But obviously, a substantial number of voters don't see a big problem. It's important to recognize that none of the education reforms of the last decade or so have been driven by public opinion. There was not a massive groundswell that said, change our schools. But public opinion regarding the reforms that governments want to bring in has to be manipulated and managed so that the visceral, tireless opposition to those reforms is limited to a few people or a few organizations that can be dismissed as special interest groups. And everybody else gets persuaded that the changes must be made or that other things on a political agenda are really more important. It's vital to this strategy that the public becomes concerned that something must be done because things at school are a mess, you know, that schools are failing. So that's the first step. The second step is to undermine public education to the point where it starts to deserve the criticism. Simply put, to make schools worse. Actually, it isn't all that difficult. Cut funding, increase class size, reduce teachers' professional autonomy, their right to make good decisions, contract out other jobs, insult and demoralize everybody, constrain school board decisions, close small schools, let buildings deteriorate, reward bad management behavior. Making schools worse isn't difficult at all. Now, what is difficult is try to figure out under these circumstances what to do if you love public education. Because defenders of public education get caught in a double bind. If you point out how schools are deteriorating as a result of that list of things that I just described, then public confidence starts to be shaken. They start to worry. They start to say, gee, I guess schools are in a mess. On the other hand, if you defend the fine work that schools are doing under the circumstances, you risk sending the message that schools absorb the cuts and things are still fine. It's a very difficult strategic problem for activists. It's hard for governments to come up with justifications for all the destructions. You know, they've got case-by-case examples. You know, this school was too small, there really wasn't enough population, electricity cost too much there, let's have a four-day school week, and so on. So you can come up with it case-by-case. But you really have to have a powerful general argument. And it comes down to two core messages. The first, these ideas that really have to be embedded in the population about the purpose of education. The first is bundled into the concept of what they call accountability, which is the way it's applied, really nothing more than a puritanical sort of Presbyterian idea that left to their own devices, people are lazy, wasteful, indolent, low achievers who must be controlled from above or by the god of competition. Both probably works better. I mean, it really is an accountability taken as proof to me that you did what I told you to, which is sort of the working, active way accountability is implied, makes the assumption that unless somebody was looking and cracking that whip, nobody, whether they're a six-year-old in kindergarten or the teacher or somebody cleaning the hallways, would really be doing their job. And so the control from above appears in things like more testing, more rigorous curriculum, more homework, and of course, more detailed contracts, more restrictions of what you can do. The list is very long. But again, the idea here is that left alone, people will behave badly, shirk, cheat, and slack off. Now, the other core justification is also related to both religion and the markets. I call it the scarcity paradigm, that the idea that there just isn't enough for everyone. This is a fundamental, or fundamentalist, take your pick, argument. I mean, after all, there isn't enough room in heaven for everybody, is there? I mean, it's an exclusive place just for the select, the elect, the best. And a competitive system is not about everybody winning. In a competition, there are way more losers than winners, right? Just like in the Olympics. The market works by convincing people that there isn't enough good stuff to go around. That when many people have something like a public education, it just can't be very good. To have a really good education, then, you must have something that other people can't afford or appreciate. The scarcity paradigm is a really important and not very much addressed piece of neoliberalism and marketing and all that stuff. It's really related to dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction is absolutely essential for a market as God system to prosper. I mean, what would happen if we all thought our teeth were white enough and our jeans were blue enough and our cars were big enough or our computers were fast enough? We would stop buying. It doesn't work unless we're dissatisfied. So dissatisfaction with what you have has to really be driven into a market system. It has to become part of the psychology, part of the culture. It's one of the things that troubles me so much about all the marketing that goes on to adolescents, you know, Naomi Klein stuff, all that target marketing of kids. What you're marketing is dissatisfaction, unhappiness, never having enough, never having the right things. Because without that, the rest all falls apart. So still on the scarcity paradigm, we get to money. Of course, there just isn't enough of it. It's scarce, after all. Certainly, you folks, being from a poor province in a poor country, and there just isn't enough in BC to fund health care and education properly, certainly not enough to do those things and still give tax cuts to the deserving rich. Choices, choices. Well, as a country, we've parlayed the scarcity idea into action, at least in terms of education funding. Last month, the OECD reported that spending on elementary and secondary education in Canada on a percentage of GDP basis, so as a percentage of national wealth, we're now down to 19th out of 30 countries, well behind the U.S. You know, we used to pride ourselves on how we fund public, well behind the U.S., well behind Mexico, well behind Portugal, well behind countries that I'm sure if you asked the population would assume nothing was being spent on education. Well, the cuts in real spending in B.C. are right in with the trend, although that old Enron-esque trick of playing with accounting methods will be used to try to deceive some of the people some of the time. Now, this low spending, comparatively, is despite the fact that education in Canada faces some built-in diseconomies, some expenses related to things like climate and geography, running parallel systems in two languages, and a parallel religious system in many provinces, graduating a very high proportion of all students, diversity of languages and cultures in our classrooms. These are diseconomies, things that are expensive. This doesn't make any of them bad, per se. But the characteristics of our system build in additional costs compared to, say, running a U.S. system. To argue that a good public education system is too expensive for Canada is truly obscene when the federal government has a $9.1 billion surplus and when provinces make willful decisions to empty their coffers into the richest 5 or 10% other populations.